The time is now. Volume 1, Episode 18. Thank you so much for listening. This is Employment Law Now, and I am still Mike Schmidt. You know, as I said back in July and August when I did my interview of former EEOC General Counsel David Lopez, there are just some interviews that are particularly worthy of two parts and breaking it up into two parts because there's so much information to cover, and I don't want to just limit it to one episode of 30 or 40 minutes. Today is the start of another one of those, I think, as I offer you the first of two parts on an extremely important topic that people are grappling with these days, and that is involving gender pay equity audits. But first, there are a couple of things that I just want to update you on. So we start with our DC Now update segment. Our DC Now update segment. We've talked about several hot-button issues and how the Trump administration and current Congress have or will have impact those issues. The joint employer liability is generally one of those. It's so important to many of you out there, if you're in the staffing business or if you use temp agencies or you're involved in the franchisor-franchisee model. Efforts have been made recently to undo the Obama administration's expanded theory of joint employer liability, particularly for private labor law violations under the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA, as well as the Fair Labor Standards Act, the FLSA, as well as try to undo what's been out there from a case law standpoint, which really is all over the place on developing standards for employers to be able to know what they're doing, what they can do, what they shouldn't do, to increase their potential exposure as a joint employer. Many have seen, and probably most have seen, the recent efforts by the Trump administration and Congress as a pro-business effort. And the United States House of Representatives just passed a bill this week, largely along party lines, and it's called the Save the Local Business Act, which provides that there will be joint employer liability only when one company has, quote, direct control, end quote, when one company has direct control over the other's workers. We'll see now what the Senate decides to do, and we will continue to follow this, but I did want to just make sure you knew where this stood in terms of congressional action, as I do think that there will be some ultimate legislation signed into law dealing with this joint employer liability issue. The overtime issue is certainly one that continues to be discussed, and on the overtime issue, in a somewhat surprising move, I guess, the Trump administration Department of Labor just announced that it will actually proceed with the appeal of the Texas judge's decision that the Obama Department of Labor overtime rule was invalid. Why, you ask? Why would the Republican administration want to pursue an appeal of a decision striking down the Obama overtime rule? Well, you may remember that one of the issues in that case was whether the Department of Labor, as a threshold matter, has the authority to address salary thresholds in its rulemaking on the overtime exemption issue. And even the current Department of Labor, even the current Trump administration Department of Labor, does not want a decision out there which effectively says that the Department of Labor is unable to engage in any rulemaking related to the salary threshold issue. So They're appealing it, I think, to that extent, but at the same time, the Department of Labor has also filed a motion to stay everything, to just freeze the entire litigation and buy time to come up with its own rule. And we've seen, because and we've talked about that in prior episodes, this RFI that the new Trump Department of Labor sent out there, a really exhaustive set of questions to all of the stakeholders out there, whether it's asking questions about job duties, salary thresholds, different rules for different parts of the country, and essentially the Department of Labor is asking the court to freeze everything so that it has time to study all the responses that have come in and perhaps propose its own new rule. We don't know if there are going to be proposed changes to the duties test still. We don't know exactly what they're going to do with the salary basis test. I think we are all in somewhat of agreement that the Department of Labor is going to do something, acknowledging that the current salary thresholds are probably a little too low. There will likely be a split the current baby result, I think, where you get the salary threshold increased to somewhere in the mid-30s, mid-30,000s as a threshold, but we will see. And that process will take some time, but like the joint employer liability issue, this issue on overtime and the overtime exemption rules is continuing to move as well. So continue to keep your eyes and ears open for that, and we will certainly continue to keep you updated on that. So we now move to our special guest now segment. You've heard it from me. You have heard it and read it everywhere, I imagine. Gender equity and pay equity are issues at the forefront of the employment law agenda of hot issues in 2017. You hear about companies doing internal audits all the time on a wide variety of issues, whether it's actually the overtime exemptions, whether it's independent contractor classifications. But here too, when it comes to gender pay equity and gender pay audits, this is something that your companies really should be thinking about as well. You hear about them and you've read about companies doing them, but you're not sure whether your company should do them or when and how your company should do them, if at all. And this is the right place to come, I hope, to answer some of those questions. Is it as simple as just looking at what base salaries you're giving to men versus women? Is it as simple as just looking at what starting salaries you are offering and where you get those starting salaries from? What about when you get an attorney or an outside consultant involved in looking at these issues internally? Should you be waiting until you get a complaint in the door, or is this something that you should be doing proactively? What about when you find something wrong doing some internal audit? Should you do something? When? How should you be doing something? I want to try to tackle some of these questions for you in this podcast. David Cohen is the founder and the president of DCI Consulting Group. He provides consulting services to employers on a wide range of HR and risk management strategies, particularly in the areas of EEO and affirmative action program development, systemic compensation statistical analyses, and comprehensive human resources self-audits. David is recognized as a national EEO and affirmative action compliance expert, and he speaks frequently before corporate leaders at Fortune 500 companies and at regional conferences. I actually just saw him at a conference in California a couple of weeks ago and was real impressed by his knowledge on this area. I like to bring people on to the podcast to talk to all of you, not only if they're knowledgeable about a particular subject matter, but also when they have a particular passion for what they do and a passion for what they are trying to communicate to you. That is David. So here is part one of my two-part interview with David Cohen on pay equity audits, how you should be doing them, when you should be doing them, and all related issues. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is terrific. Why don't you start off by telling us about your work at DCI Consulting Group and generally what your experience is with pay equity issues?
Sure. So I'm the president of DCI Consulting Group. We're based here in Washington, D.C., and we are an HR analytics firm made up of industrial psychologists and labor economists. And one of our expertise is pay equity, and we've been doing it. I've been doing this for a long time, I developed a software product that does these statistical analyses. So a company wants to do this internally. I've developed a program that does that. But we also probably do more pay equity studies than any firm out there. So we do this stuff all the time, and it's just fascinating work, and I really enjoy it.
So clearly you know a little bit about what you're talking about then today.
Yeah, a little bit.
So let's get right into it then. I mean, every study that's out there that we've been reading a lot of them and hearing a lot about them, they all demonstrate, I think, quite clearly that the average earnings of women in the United States are significantly less than the average earnings of men, which has led to this pay gap that we hear about. That in turn has led to a proliferation of equal pay laws on the federal, state, and local level, certainly. First, I would love to hear your take on why you think we seem to be hearing so much more about pay equity issues these days.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, like I said, I've been doing this for a long time, and you know, the most that we heard about pay equity studies, was coming out of OFCCP for federal contractors, and then a lot of the litigation that we saw with pay discrimination outside, you know, some of the smaller Equal Pay Act claims was at universities. But I think this area has grown exponentially, and the awareness. I mean, just look what's happened in the last couple of months, or even within the year. I think the election has struck a nerve, certainly with a lot of women. You got the Me Too movement and sexual harassment, but more broadly, right? I mean, just think about during the Obama administration. You know, the Obama administration was really pushing pay equity. The first law, right, signed in was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. But then, you know, we continued to see more. You know, there was this White House pay equity pledge asking employers to voluntarily sign up on that. And then all of a sudden, right out in Silicon Valley, you had activist shareholders that were asking companies, show us your wage gap. What are you doing in terms of pay equity? And now you've got boards asking the CEO. And now we've got pay transparency laws that say, you know, employees, talk about your pay. And a lot of these companies that have millennials, they are much more comfortable sharing information about pay, whether or not they totally understand their pay and how it's being formulated. But I think that coming together, then with Congress not passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, it is the perfect storm where we have the states now saying, fine, federally you don't want to do that, we're going to pass state laws. And then the cities are saying, well, we'll pass city laws. And they're all different and they're nuanced. So you've got city, you got state, you got shareholders, you got employees, all talking about pay equity, and you've got, you know, actors and actresses, and you've got U.S. soccer team talking about it. So it's really everywhere.
So it's affecting all industries, all employees, high wage earners, low wage earners. Really, it's an issue that's affecting everyone across the board.
Yep. Yeah. No question.
And it's amazing, and we've certainly been talking in prior episodes about, exactly to your point, how this used to be, if at all, a federal issue when it came to various employment law issues, and now we're in 2017, and we're seeing so many issues being dealt with on the state and the city levels as well. It's not just a federal situation.
Yeah, and you know what? It's not just a U.S. Issue. I mean, look, the U.K., now has a mandatory wage gap report that employers will have to file in 2018. You've got other countries that are talking about and passing pay equity laws. We've got the EEO-1, which got killed by the Trump administration. But remember, that was a report that employers would have to file every year. California almost passed that one as well. The governor just vetoed that, but that's going to happen as well. I mean, I think employers probably have to realize that this issue is not going away. It's not going away under a Trump administration. Certainly, and the pressure, on pay equity, and also the reporting. I mean, as of today, we don't have a federal comp report for pay equity, but I tell you what, my prediction, it will come.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you said as of today, you know, let's continue to check back every hour because
right.
I agree with you that this certainly is going to be coming soon. Let's give a little bit of context to this pay equity issue. What do you see, David, as the biggest cause of this pay gap?
So it's really an interesting question. You know, I get frustrated as a statistician and someone who does this work when people throw around this crude wage gap. You know, women earn 80 cents or 82 cents to the dollar. And that really is a misleading statistic, right? Because you're just comparing in the U.S., the civilian workforce, what's the average salary of men? What's the average salary of women? And what's that difference? But that doesn't take into account the type of work that people are performing, part-time, full-time. So that's one of the problems with the wage gap statistic. And when you really look at it, even looking at Bureau of Labor Statistics and other studies out there, the wage gap is probably 94 cents to the dollar. But there's still a difference, right? But what we don't know, and I don't think really anyone out there can answer the question, is what's causing that 6 cents? Is it discrimination? And is it discrimination on the part of employers? Or is it something else? You know, that something else could be things like occupational segregation or occupational choice. I mean, certainly if you look at the representation, for example, of women and minorities in technical and STEM jobs, well, guess what? Those are really high-paying jobs. So just if you look at the distribution in men and women in certain jobs and how those jobs pay, that certainly could be a cause. The other thing is starting salary. And, you know, it's so interesting because I've been saying it for years that If the government wanted to take a bite out of pay equity, you know, what we always find is starting salaries are the root of all pay equity issues, and that if men and women come in at different rates and we pay for performance and we do merit increases and those are percent increases, well, what happens is salaries will diverge over time and the difference will only get greater versus converge, which is why you're seeing the states passing laws banning the use of prior salary when determining a new salary, because they're trying to remove the salary negotiation and they're trying to remove the ability of employers to pay people for what they can get them for and not what they're worth. So I think it's a combination of things. Discrimination certainly could be one of them. It's not what we see, in that it's not a systemic problem across corporate America. Certainly discrimination exists, but a lot of it, can be, narrowed to starting salary and the differences in the distribution of men and women in types of jobs.
So one of the things I'm hearing from what you just said, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the existence of a pay gap at a company does not in and of itself mean that the company is doing something illegal.
So if you look at some of these wage gap studies that are coming out of Silicon Valley, where companies are being forced to present their wage gap. And you're seeing numbers from 98 cents to the dollar to 99 cents to the dollar. We've done quite a bit of those studies for Silicon Valley. And here's what we tell our clients, that these wage gap results and these wage gap studies don't tell you anything whether or not you have potential problems in your pay practices. So I can be at 100 cents to the dollar using those studies and have evidence of systemic discrimination in my workforce. Conversely, I can have a 20 cent different, 80 cents to the dollar, and yet when we do a real Title VII type of analysis, we don't find any evidence of discrimination. So it's a useful tool, these wage gap numbers, but they are not Title VII type analyses to identify discrimination.
That's interesting. And so we're going to get, you and I are going to get into sort of the weeds and the nuts and bolts on what are we talking about when we talk about pay equity audits, how do we actually go about doing them, how do you actually go about doing them when you're working with companies. And I'm going to get there, and I promise the listeners I'm going to get there. I do have just a couple of other questions from a context standpoint for you, because I find sort of your historical discussion of all of these issues really fascinating. So you have somebody out there who's listening to this, or they've attended a seminar or a conference and they've heard people talk about pay equity audits. Why do you think pay audits should be done if you're a company? And from a timing standpoint, when should a company consider doing a pay audit?
Yeah, so why do it? And it, you know, a lot of times companies are very reluctant to do it if they've never done it before, because they're always very afraid, to open the box and look in to see what they have.
Careful what you wish for. Sort of.
Yeah, because here's the thing. Once you do it, and if you find a problem, well, you better do something about it, because knowing about it and not doing anything is worse than not knowing that there's a problem in the first place.
So before everyone shuts this podcast off, now that you've just said that, I do want to get from you, because I don't think you're suggesting that everyone should just sort of play this ignorance game and not do them at all. There certainly are good, valid reasons why companies should consider doing pay audits.
Yeah, I mean, no question, right? So you got to step up. If you've never done it before, you're going to do it. It's not as going to be as bad as you think. It never is. I always have clients say we've never done it and we're frightened to see what we find. And what they always come back with is that wasn't that bad. Maybe there's pockets. But look, every employer that I work with wants to do the right thing, and they want to, if they have a problem, fix it. So you have a corporate responsibility to do it, and most employers want to do that. But also, if there's a problem, you want to mitigate your risk and your legal exposure by fixing the problem.
Yeah, I think that's the best answer to me in terms of sort of stopping the bleeding.
Yeah.
Make sure that you're getting ahead of the issue if there is an issue. And certainly if there is no issue, you're all the better for knowing that now. From a timing perspective, then, when should a company consider doing a pay audit? So many companies out there believe that, well, let's wait till I get a complaint, or let's wait till I have some initial notification of an issue. When do you suggest, from a timing standpoint, companies think about doing a pay audit?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's, at that point, it's too late. It really is, because, you know, if you're going to make an adjustment, you're going to bring salaries up. So if you get a lawsuit and they're requesting, you know, a data snapshot prior to that date, well, it is what it is. Those salaries were those salaries. So here's my recommendation. First off, if you're a contractor, you've got to do this every single year. So
you mean a federal contractor? You're talking about
federal contractor. Yeah.
Right.
So if you're under OFCCP jurisdiction, the regs say you'll do this, and it doesn't describe what this is. It's just an evaluation of your comp system to identify impediments to EEO. But the timing, I love to do this before merit, and here's why: because we're in that planning cycle. And if I find a problem and I need to make salary adjustments, I roll that right into the merit process, right? So we're not going to send a letter to an employee and say, look, we've identified for the last 20 years of your career, we've been discriminated against you. Here's $5,000 increase. You roll it into merit. It's into normal planning. If I'm going to adjust your salary by $5,000, I say, you know, we've done a market study, we've looked at other things, and your salary is being adjusted. In my career, I have yet to find an employee who comes back and files a complaint. Hasn't happened yet.
Interesting. So you're certainly recommending the approach of get ahead of this before there's even been any kind of complaint, and to the extent that you haven't done one yet as a company, putting aside the federal contracting requirements, companies really should start thinking about doing these audits.
Absolutely.
Big, small, in between? I mean, is there sort of a bright line rule for the bigger you are, the more of a good idea it is for you to do it than if you're just a small mom and pop shop? I mean, is there a cost-benefit analysis that goes into whether to do these things?
Well, you know, if you're a smaller company, if you're a small mom pop, you have 50 employees, it's really hard to do a statistical study. So you're more doing an Equal Pay Act type of evaluation, just kind of looking at the distribution of pay, evaluating your policies and procedures. You know, a mid-size employer, you know, certainly you want to look at base pay. And then for larger employers, I think you want to branch out and look at other forms of compensation. But I just think small, medium, large, I just think it's a best practice. And once again, what I find, if employers want to know if there's a problem and they want to get ahead of it.
Yeah, and so the next question that I have for you is, I think, naturally a question that will sound self-serving, but it's an important question for you anyway. Companies obviously tend to get a little squeamish when it comes to engaging outside consultants on compliance issues, particularly before lawsuits are even started. What's your response to that, and what do you see as the benefit of working with a consultant beyond outside counsel, particularly in this pay equity audit arena?
Yeah, so, you know, this is what I'll say, and obviously I'm biased, right, because this is what I do for a living, but it's very rare that I find that a company has someone in-house that has, that's a subject matter expert and has the ability to conduct these types of analyses, and here's why. You know, in order to run these analyses, and what we found is, if you're just a statistician, you may not understand how to do this type of study. You need to have an understanding of HRIS and data. You need to have an understanding of compensation. You need to have an understanding of statistics and regression. And you also have an understanding of the law, right? Because, you know, when we do these types of study, there's something called putting together similarly situated employee groupings. How do you group people together for purposes of conducting the analysis? That is an art, not a science. And if your groupings are wrong, your analysis is wrong. So, yeah, I find that you really need to bring in an expert, and it should be a team. You know, you need legal. Because when I do these studies, I want them covered under privilege. I want my work covered under privilege, because I'm then going to provide my study to legal, who then in return going to provide legal advice to his or her client, and especially when it comes to making salary adjustments. So I just think that you need the expertise, comp, HRS, stats, and legal, in order to do a proper analysis.
That certainly makes sense. So let's get a little bit into the weeds here, and I want to take this, if you'll indulge me, sort of step by step, so that those who are listening and thinking about this from a company standpoint, that they may want to put this on their to-do list either for the end of the year or to start the new year in 2018, I want to give them some real practical, here are some to-do action items. So let's start from the beginning. You get the first call, David, that someone wants to engage you as a consultant. What are the specific things that you do first at that point?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like I said, you know, 20 years ago when I was doing this and my phone would ring and someone would say, we want you to conduct a systemic pay study, pay equity study. And I would say, let me guess, you're a federal contractor, you've got an OFCCP audit. And it was simple, because we would do it by location, we'd look at base pay, I'd run some simple statistics, and we'd call it a day. That world has changed. And now when my phone rings and someone says, hey, we'd like to do a pay equity study, I ask, what is the purpose? What are you trying to accomplish? Is it Are you in a state like Massachusetts or Oregon that has a safe harbor provision and you're trying to take advantage of a safe harbor provision? Is it California and you want to do a California pay equity study? Is it a shareholder and you want to look at your wage gap? Is it a Title VII analysis? Is it OFCCP? So the first thing I try to do with the client is say, what are our goals? What are we trying to do? The second thing that I do is I say, all right, before we begin, do you have the authority and the budget to fix a problem? Because unlike other things in life, pay equity, right, it's one of the few things that we can solve by throwing money at it.
That's right.
So if the client says, well, no, we don't have a budget or the authority to make adjustments, well, we need to rethink what we're doing, because, you know, if we do this study, I want to make sure that we can remedy anything that we have.
So you weren't talking just when you said budget. You're not just referring to the budget to do the audit itself. You're talking about, is there a budget? Is there a stomach for doing something about it if you happen to identify issues?
Yeah. And what I find is a lot of clients, what they'll do is they'll have a set-aside budget for equity adjustments that's separate from merit. So they have their equity pool, and then they have their merit pool, and that this is a separate fund that could be used to make necessary salary adjustments. Most of the time, I find the pool is bigger than what we need to fix anything. So it's like I said, it's usually not as big as people think.
Yeah, and so when you're talking about the authority for that piece of it, who do you typically deal with on the inside? Do you deal directly with a board of directors? Do you deal directly with a CEO, an in-house counsel, HR? Who are you tending to deal with?
Yeah, so it's usually in-house counsel, it's compensation and compliance, and with the support from the C-suite, from the CEO down, that's aware of this project, that's committed to this project, that has released funds for this project for adjustments. And then we work with compensation to do the analysis. And if there are adjustments, we work through compensation.
Interesting. And so you get that first call to be engaged. You want to go over the goals with them. What are they trying to accomplish? You want to confirm that they've got the authority and the budget for doing this, and also at the end of the day for being able to remedy any issues that get identified. Is there anything that you ask other than that when you're first getting this call before you're actually starting the engagement?
Yeah. So then the next thing that we ask is, what data do you have? And this is always a really fun conversation that we have with a company in comp, because we'll say, all right, now we're going to put these groups together, we're going to run a regression analysis, and we want to control for legitimate factors that affect pay. And they say, well, what do you mean by that? And I say, well, you know, things like prior experience and education and certifications and performance ratings, and so on and so forth. And they say, okay, got it. And I say, all right, now tell me about your comp system. You know, how do you pay people? What determines starting salary? What determines merit increases and promotions? And they walk through that. And then I say, okay, now I've whiteboarded. I have 25 things that affect pay. What do you have in your HRIS system? And they go, oh, well, we don't have any of that in our system. And I say, okay, so we'll have to start with our analysis with the data you do have in your system. So things like hire date, I can do time and company, grade date, time and grade. I'll use age. I know this sounds crazy, but we use age as a proxy for previous experience, which, by the way, tends to be the single best predictor of your salary is your age. And if you think about that intuitively, it'll make sense for most industries. But that's the conversation we have. Tell me about your comp system. What are the factors that affect pay? What do you have readily available? And then I structure analysis with the data points that are readily available in the HRIS system.
And if I'm a company thinking about doing this kind of pay equity audit, and this all sounds great to me, and this is really something I should think about doing it, but I am a little concerned about the cost of doing these things. Is this a situation where it's, you know, dive in once you decide you've got to do it, and it just is what it is? Or are there sort of stages to this that we can do, say, an initial phase one and draw some preliminary conclusions about the environment and what's going on at the company without then having to do a full-fledged pay audit?
Yeah, and we've had clients who have done that, and they'll say, look, for the first year, because we don't know what we don't know, and so let's just kind of sample the first year. Let's run one division at a time to take it in chunks. So that certainly is an option, to just look at different subsets. You know, for example, we've had projects where year one, we're going to look at the sales division. Year two, we're going to look at administrative support. So there are ways in which you can break out the workforce and just kind of take it one at a time. But my advice, tear the Band-Aid off, get into it, and once you've done it the first year, you've got a good benchmark, and things tend to get better over time.
Understood. That makes perfect sense. Well, that was a great start, I think, I hope. We're now going to be getting into issues dealing with, so you've decided that a pay equity audit is something you should think about doing. What are the real nuts and bolts? What are the practical how-to questions that you'd want to ask David about proceeding with a pay equity audit, and what you should be doing if and when you find out that maybe there is something wrong within your company? Part two will be released in our next episode, and I hope you listen in for that one, so that we can get a great conclusion to this interview with David Cohen. I really thank you, as always, for listening to the podcast. Thank you so much to all of you who have been sending me emails and posting comments, talking generally about the podcast, offering me subject matter suggestions for future episodes. Please keep them coming. I hope I'm providing a valuable resource for you. And until the next time, I do hope all of your labor is productive.